All right. Well, hello, everyone. This is Unscripted Study, a new podcast coming out on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Podcast focused on discussing faith, society, and life. I'm here with Benjamin Battles and Harrison Cohn, and myself, Benjamin Rollins. We're some friends, knew each other since college, and let's get started. I currently work in education. I've been a high school English teacher for about 10 years. And part of what prompted me to kind of initiate this journey, I've always been fascinated with, one, theology as a Christian, but two, how theology works and how it functions in our society. What can we apply from those precepts and principles into our society? And what can that tell us about where we're headed, about where we've been, and of course, about where we are? And with my connection to these guys, like I said earlier, we met in college. We've been in contact more or less since then. And looking forward to, like I said, just beginning this journey, wherever it takes us.
Is that me? I'm up next.
Yeah.
All right. I am Ben Battles. The other Ben said, we met in college. We've known each other for a long time now, basically a decade, a little more than a decade.
Yeah.
And my background is a little all over the place. College was an art major, so I did a lot of freelance art and design and a variety of like digital art positions. And then just like Ben, I went into teaching where I taught public education for 5 years, taught high school, taught the same subject, actually, we have that in common, for 5 years. And then I have recently accepted a job doing learning design in the private sector there. So still doing education, but for adults now, whose job depends on it. So it's kind of fun. And my faith background, born in a Christian home. My father is a pastor, actually, and definitely grew up with that as a backbone of my life. The church was in somewhat literal ways, like a second home to me. And so it's always been something that I've, you know, just kind of had in my life. Yeah, I think for me, the interest has always been just that the world at large seems so poor at giving us real answers for some of the hard questions in life. And sometimes I'm not sure that there are answers. And I think that there's something so literal about the way that Jesus says and calls us to follow him. It's not a set of check boxes to check off and then you accomplish, you know, righteousness or perfection. It's implicit in his call as rabbi, as teacher, as, you know, the leader, that it's not something you're capable of doing on your own. And it really, to get through life in a way that is satisfying and abundant, it requires that close, you know, one step behind trying to follow Jesus wherever he is actively going. You know, that's kind of the beauty of the resurrection, is that he didn't end his ministry. It's still happening. So I think that's, for me, you know, where a lot of my head is at when it comes to those kinds of questions about like how I see the world, the lens that I view the world through. I think when I was younger, it was a lot more macroscopic. I really wanted to have those solid, rock solid answers that could, you know, just kind of describe, you know, a theory of everything. And as I get older, it just seems so impossible. And I just feel microscopic, you know, just looking right at my life, where is Jesus, where is God taking me today? Best case scenario tomorrow. Yeah, that's me.
Yeah. All right.
Cool. Thanks, Ben. Hey, everybody. I'm Harrison Cohn. I likewise have known Ben Squared, which is Ben and Ben, for what, 15 years now? Something close to that.
Close to it.
We met in 2009, fall of 2009, at the Georgia College Wesley Foundation, ice cream social, probably something like that. The first couple weeks of school.
Yeah, probably.
We all got plugged into ministry really quickly, and house church, and as I mentioned, Wesley Foundation, and then professional lives got, I think, the best of us for a while, and I'm just excited to be chatting with you guys on a regular basis. Thanks to Ben Rollins for the invite to be a part of this. I'm super excited to just, I think, to get heady and deep with some of this stuff. I don't claim to be a philosopher or a great theologian or anything, but I think there's something really basic, iron sharpens iron, when people of same spirit, same thought, same desire can get together and work through the mysteries of Scripture and really come to a place of contentment, I think is what's great. So Ben kind of talked a little, Ben Battles talked a little bit of, we're gonna have to figure that out, Ben Battles said he did art education. Ben Rollins didn't mention it, but he and I both were in the rhetoric program at Georgia College together, which is the best degree program on the face of the planet. Probably absolutely not so much that Dr. Vail has moved on, but God rest him. But that was formative for me when how to really think critically and how to apply critical engagement and thought and really start wrestling with not what is seen, but also what is unseen, just like in every circumstance that, politically, romantically, parentally, relationally, like whatever aspects I find myself, it's always asking myself what is beyond the surface that is important. I think that program really, that degree program really helps. So I'm a big proponent of college education. But for me, kind of theologically, I have become much more content with letting the mysteries of God just remain the mysteries of God. I was just talking to my wife the other day, and we had heard something. I can't remember the details, but I was like, you know what? The Bible authors just don't care to tell us why. We don't know. In church this morning, the pastor was talking about why did God choose Israel and that land, and why did he choose, Abraham and why, all that kind of stuff. And he's like, because he did, it's like, because he's God. And so I think growing to a place of being comfortable, that's very Western of us. I think I'm looking forward to talking about this article that Ben will talk about here in a minute, but it's very Western of us to want to know why. And I think Jesus wasn't Western. He was definitely Eastern. And so just, it's not so much why, but things just are. Yeah. And so I'm excited to get into that. By trade, I work recruitment for a company called Passages Israel. I take college students to Israel on discipleship programming. And I'm also an author. So excited to chat with Ben. And we'll probably talk to God too, I'm sure, in this podcast as it rolls out.
Amen. And if you want, you could just refer to me as Superior Ben, and then Ben Battles can be Inferior Ben.
Lester Ben.
Yeah. Hi, Lester.
I think that's, I'm feeling the Lord with that. I don't know.
Ben that Jesus loved.
Yes. Very good. That's perfect.
Yeah. We can go with city names too. I guess I'm like technically Ben of Gainesville.
There you go.
To go back far enough, but it's interesting. Harrison brought up, we don't really get into this context, but yes, we have known each other for a very long time, the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I haven't like regularly spoken to Harrison really since that time. I mean, we spent a lot of time together back in college. And so it is interesting and exciting to sort of like step back into some relationships that, meant so much in such a formative time. And just, like you said, kind of get away from us. So there's a lot of layers, I think, to where this conversation might go that, really maybe are more personal than they'll resonate with anyone else. But, I think it'd be fun. So,
absolutely.
Agreed.
Absolutely. And to add a little bit more, I wanted to introduce Ben Battles and Harrison Cone. But for me, I grew up in essentially a hybrid of non-denominational and Pentecostal church. And so my experience was unique I think compared to a lot of people when I got to college, and especially to Ben and Harrison, in that I recognized that I was definitely in a minority position in terms of my doctrinal holdings, in terms of my experiences, in terms of my perspectives. And, you know, over time since then, you know, they've only become stronger. And, you know, I think scripturally, you know, the Lord speaks to this idea in Deuteronomy 29:29, when he says, the secret things are the Lord's, but those that he chooses to reveal are with us forever. And so ultimately, they're just going to be secrets, right? They're going to be things we don't have the answer to why or how. We just have the answer to it is. And I think we see that through the proclamation through the burning bush, right? I will be what I will be, right? He says to Moses when asked of his name. And likewise, looking forward to, as I said earlier, looking forward to the journey. There's an article that we're going to begin with. It's from Christianity Today, and I'll put a link to it in the description of the podcast. But for those listening currently, it is titled Christianity is Not Necessary for Democracy. It's by Paul Miller. It was released several months ago, in earlier this year in March. And essentially, to give you a summary, the author is positing the question, essentially to his audience and a larger audience of evangelical Christians, who state that our faith is necessary in order for not only democracy's survival, but its perpetuation, and its perpetuation in righteousness. And so he discusses some common lines of thought from his friends who believe that. That not only did Christianity introduce, you know, universal literacy, the priesthood of all believers, but it also established preconditions for democracy that are seen very clearly in American society. And however, he counters that by discussing countries around the world who are not predominantly Christian, or who are sort of nominally Christian, who have democratic societies or governments and countries that are considered free by different indexes, and essentially ends the article by posing some questions on whether or not it's true that Christianity is necessary for democracy. He does concede that it offers benefits and it definitely enhances the idea of democracy, but leaves it open-ended to whether or not it's critical or necessary for democracy to have Christianity as a supporting base, ideally through governmental structure, which is what his oppositionists would argue. And then ultimately concludes by saying, even if it's true, like he tends to believe, that Christianity is not necessary, or democracy does not need Christianity, then it doesn't diminish his faith. And that ultimately his faith, as he states, in one of the final paragraphs, is to be clear, it is not wrong to seek or use political power. We do so every time we cast a vote. But Christians are sometimes faced with a choice between maintaining our principles and maintaining our power. The myth tells us that the choice is illusory, that our power is inherently principled, that the survival of America itself is at stake, that our country will not survive unless we remain in charge, which compels us to do whatever is necessary to keep power. It might be a comforting myth, but a myth it remains. And so with that in mind, I wanted to kind of begin with the question. There's a famous text by Aldous Huxley titled The Brave New World, which is essentially a dystopian piece of fiction, which emerged and offered that the future would be most likely dystopian, but that it would be so through our own choice, our own volition. And at the heart of it, I think there's this implied message that democracy has so many preconditions that are important, that are critical for it to exist, that those are just not sustainable over a long period of time, thousands of years, more than hundreds of years. And that every system of government ultimately leads to some sort of authoritarian display. And that if that authoritarian display can convince you that it is the right way forward, then that is the best form of government, even if you don't necessarily want it to be. And so I think, you know, in today's society, we encounter this notion of there are, particularly in younger generations, people who identify not necessarily as believers or who maybe don't go to church as much as previous generations. And so we're left with the question, if fiction likes to indicate that a dystopian sort of pessimistic future is the end all be all, and on the other, and while Christianity still for the most part is the majority and determining ethic in this country, what would it be like if Christianity was not that major determining ethic in our discourse, in our government, in our policies, in our procedures, in our sort of in our non-official acts of decorum? If that was gone, would our democracy stay? Would it change drastically, or would it give way to something totalitarian? And so that's the question that I pose. If Christianity loses its holding place as the central driving ethic of this country, what happens to democracy?
Happy to take a first stab.
All right.
Yeah, go for it.
I read, I'm reading a book called Pilgrims of the Earth by Ken Follett. I'm late to the game. I watched the show on HBO in college. It's funny, I'm talking to college buddies, reading the book of the show I was watching in college. It's fun. But anyway, and it's about a monk and his trials through the 1100s. And you're posing that question, I'm reading this, I have to remove Christianity from any sort of governmental structure. You can have a just monarch. You can have like a just authoritarian ruler. You can have a Christian oligarchy. You could have a Christian democracy. You can have a Christian republic. And it's not necessarily the form of government so much as the ethics imposed by the religion. And I think, for one, I don't know that his article really applies to America, because we're not a democracy. I read a book, which I highly recommend to both of you. It's called Tides of War. Is this podcast just going to be about books we've read and we're recommending so far? I read Pilgrims of the Earth.
Yeah, for me, it'll mostly be podcasts I listen to.
Yeah.
Descriptions of books I read.
Yeah. But I read this book a while ago, and it was kind of a drag, but it's great. It's about Alcibiades, Peloponnesian War, and it's just dense, and it reads like philosophy. And so, I mean, Socrates is in it, so I suppose it should. But the terrifying thing for me in this book is how Alcibiades, one minute with the Greek democracy as a hero, the next minute he's exiled, the next minute he's back as a hero, the next minute he's exiled. Like, the people are just so whimsical with their loves and their affections. And the scary thing is that it's genuine every time. And this is historical fiction, but the reason why I say it doesn't apply, I don't think his article applies to our country, is because our founders set up this country to not be a majority ruled democracy, right? It's set up to be a republic. It has checks and balances in place that you could even argue that it's not Christian, but you can argue that Christian influence had so permeated the world, the Western world specifically, so thickly, that even guys like Thomas Paine, who were anti-Christians, were influenced by the morality and the ethics and the philanthropy and the human rights and the individual liberties that only came out of Christianity. Like, no other religion has had the same effect on the world as far as human rights as Christianity has. So can democracy exist without Christianity? Absolutely. We've seen it in history. But can it persevere without the moral integrity that comes from the Bible and the Christian faith? I would argue no. And even then, if we talk about A Brave New World, I think if you were to go back to the 50s and 60s and you were to show anyone there what 2023 would be like, they would be like, what a horrible dystopian society that is. Like, we're living it. Like, we're actively, like, we're right now in a dystopian society. So that's my initial take to that question, Ben, is no, Christianity is not needed for democracy. But if I were to go ahead and substitute what I think he means is does our republic need Christianity? My answer to that would be yes, because it was founded on the ethics and the principles of Christianity. And once you start stripping those away, you'll start seeing people abuse the system that was put in place to be run by moral, intelligent people. It's my take on it.
All right. Yeah.
I would say this is a hard question for me to answer, because I think there's two approaches. There's a lot to untangle, to like sort of detach from each other, to like get at a hypothetical, you know, for this situation. And I think you can take it from a spiritual perspective where God is real, God is active, he has a desire and an intention for the world that he's continually pursuing at every step in history. And kind of like we said before, he's mysterious, and it's hard for us to know, like, okay, like, well, what is his story that he's telling? And then, so it's hard to step into that space and, you know, answer that question from a human mind. I'll jump back to that in a second. But then the other way to approach that is, strictly speaking, the philosophy of Christianity, right? The ethic, the mindset of Christianity, apart from, you know, a supernatural or spiritual approach. How has it influenced modern thought? If you were to take those dispositions and perspectives out, what happens? You know, are we in a house of cards that collapses without that foundation? I think that's a different question that is probably harder for me to answer, not being so much of a historian or political philosopher in that regard. I think there's a lot of layers that I may not be qualified to unpack. I'll try my best. It won't stop me from trying. I'm not sure that I could even step into that world to really suspend my own personal perspective that there is a God who has a will and an intention for reality, and then ask that question. I'm not sure I would really be the best to do that. But from the other side of things, you know, believing that there is a God who has written our story up to this point, for Christianity to lose its foothold in America, whatever we perceive that foothold to be, will the Republic survive? For me, that perspective is yes, if it's God's will for it to do so. I think when you look back at the Old Testament narratives of the nations that were invading Israel, sometimes they were conquering God's people for God's purposes, that he was using the armies of other nations as discipline or as measures to control the balances of the world, that sure, these people are evil, but these people are even more evil. So we're going to strengthen this army to preserve whatever his, you know, plan was to bring Christ to the world. And even, you know, something as simple as I think about the argument between Peter and Jesus, when Jesus says, I will die. The world will kill me. I will die. I will suffer and die to bring about God's will. And Peter says, no, never. I won't let that happen. And Jesus rebukes him in that moment. When Peter says, no, I won't let you die, Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. He refers to that way of thinking, right? Your desire to hold on to grasp what you see in front of you and perceive as good, to hold on to it with such intention. You are missing the ultimate intention of God, and you're actually getting in the way of his will by trying to keep this man you love alive, which is counterintuitive to the way that we think, but it was very obvious to God that this was, you know, Christ was crucified at the foundations of the world, that this was what it was all building up to. So I think there's part of me that says it's not inherently intuitive what is pushing the will of God forward. It was God's will for Jesus to suffer and die at the hands of the Roman. What looked like absolute defeat was ultimately absolute victory. And so for us to, I think for Christians to assume that it's actually in our best interest for Christianity to maintain popularity, to maintain a cultural power, to continue to hold influence and sway over the world, is that same sort of man-focused assumption that I actually know what's best. It's intuitive to me. If it seems good to me, it must be good. And I have to hold on to that with everything. And so there's part of that, believe it, answering it from a spiritual perspective, like what happens to the Republic or the democracy or America if Christianity loses its place as the default position, as like the default cultural perspective. It's whatever God wants to happen. If it still needs to be a sanctuary for freedom of thought where people can experience freedoms and live in a way that allows them to be free of, trauma responses or whatever, right? If that, I'm projecting a lot, but like, if it needs to continue to be a healthy place so that people can on their own accord approach and find God, then that's what will happen. Or if it needs to be made an example of, if there's some way that in stepping away from Christianity, it loses some moral integrity that is offensive to the purposes of God, and he needs to make a object lesson of like, look what happens when you step away from these things, he will. I can't make those decisions for him. It's impossible for me to know. I mean, maybe at the point when, you know, that happens in America, you know, there's so many people who are invested in trying to chart out, you know, when will this happen? Will it happen? Right. When's that going to happen on the map? Maybe by the time that happens, Jesus comes back again and the whole world collapses. Like, we don't, you know, I don't know. So answering it, I think, from the perspective that God does exist, ultimately there's nothing we could do to threaten his throne. I have no idea. I have no idea what happens to America if the, you know, and I almost don't think it's important. But from the strictly secular perspective of the thoughts of Christianity, the perspectives of Christianity and what they offer, what happens if Christianity stops being the default popular opinion, I think it could signal a dramatic change that would open the doors for some kind of political instability. I don't think we're quite as stable as sometimes we think we are. I think it's really easy to live in a developed country and watch global news and be like, well, whatever's happening over there is crazy, but it'll never happen here. And I'm not really convinced that that's true. Whatever insane thing has happened throughout history could happen here. And in the terms of great civilizations, like, we're really not that old. You know, there's a lot of road left for things to change and change dramatically. It could happen. But also, I feel like I lost my train of thought there for a second. But also, assuming Christianity loses sway, loses popularity, I think part of what keeps it popular is the fact that it is popular, so people can appeal to it as like a sort of lever of like, well, if I seem Christian, then now I have power. So people are playing into people who are not really true, honest, good actors of, you know, like believing these principles, believing in God, may present themselves that way for the purposes of gaining cultural capital. And when we reach the tipping point of where that's no longer a meaningful lever, you may see a dramatic swing the other way. And if we survive that, if the country survives that, it could just be a season. Maybe we swing so far away from Christianity and the ethics that it introduced to society, like you were talking about, Harrison, that it was built on a foundation of these ethics. Maybe we swing so far away from that, that people go, whoa, hold on. If things were better 30, 40, 100 years ago, maybe we should, you know, correct. I mean, the pendulum swings all the time. It swings seemingly every 4 to 8 years. You know, and then when you zoom out a lot more at, you know, the trends of generations, it swings even more. I think I tend to agree with the author of this article here that, philosophically speaking, just from a, not thinking about like how important it is to be in connection with the divine, like if God is really real, it's the most important thing there is, but just talking about the thoughts about God, not God himself, just talking about the attitudes or perspectives that come with a cultural Christianity, I'm not convinced it's essential to the continuance of our society. I think I agree with him that it is a good influence, but maybe not the foundation. And it is possible that it's sort of, I think it's possible that the country would continue to exist and continue maybe to exist very successfully, depending on your metric of success, without a huge respect for Christianity as a thought influence there.
I think I'm going to have to disagree in part. On the one hand, I'm convinced that on the larger scale of there being a God, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, I think, yes, this idea that the journey of this particular country, the journey of America, along with all others, is part of a narrative that's already been shaped, right, from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at it from a biblical perspective, you know, whenever the end of end times happens, right, whenever things are coming to a culmination, there has to be a decrease. And so in part, every civilization tends towards that. And so I think,
can you elaborate on that? What do you mean by there needs to be a decrease?
I think if you're going to have let's take America, for example, if you're going to have a country historically, for the most part, that has operated as sort of the world's, I don't want to say moral compass, because that's probably too much of a hyperbole, but has operated as kind of a city on a hill, in a sense of we shine the light of our democracy, which I think is essentially a synonym for our Christianity. And through that, we do things that are both appropriate and inappropriate, convinced of our own rightness.
Sure.
And so I think if we're going to see the rise of evil forces and principles and movements that are counter to what is good, you have to see a decrease in something that is operating as that city on a hill. Otherwise, people can just look to it for correction. But if it's not there, then how do you course correct, right? How do you adjust if you yourself are not necessarily a predominantly Christian nation? And so to me, that's sort of the biblical larger scale perspective. And then in terms of philosophy or the dispositions of Christianity, I'm convinced that it is so interwoven into how we operate governmentally and societally that if you were to remove it even over time and not necessarily violently all at once, that you would see the governmental system itself not function. And I'll reference this. This is going to seem out of left field reference, but during the Byzantine Empire, so the Western Roman Empire had collapsed. This was all the Eastern Roman Empire. That's all that existed. And this was after Byzantium had declared Christianity as the national religion, essentially, or it had support from the government. There was a emperor who was somewhat unpopular and was put into position of, the people were revolting against him in Constantinople. And so they were revolting in basically an ancient civic center, an arena, an auditorium. And his guards were telling him, these people are rebelling. You just need to kill them. That's how you handle uprisings. But his issue was he had converted to Christianity and he said, I can't do that. I can't function with that old morality system anymore. And so if I lose power, that's just what it is. But I can't just kill these people. And so I think at its heart, Christianity changes the heart, right? It's an inward to outward. And so if, as Jesus said, right, it's not what comes out, but what goes in, right? It's what I consume. It's not what goes in, but what goes out, pardon me, that defiles a man. And so if a governmental structure which operates as a mouthpiece is not declaring Christian ethics, then that is what ultimately defiles it. And I think that's what ultimately brings it down, so to say. And so that's why I refer to them as synonymous, but also as synonyms in America. I'm not saying on a global scale. That's beyond my scope. And I think that's beyond the scope of what is the purpose of this republic or democracy. But within this country, I think they are infinitely inseparable.
What is infinitely inseparable? Christianity and democracy?
Yes. Yes.
I think the reason why I don't buy that is because it is so easy for movements, cultural movements, political movements, thought categories to appropriate the surface of another philosophy. For instance, I mean, I think you made an interesting point about how when you have leaders who say, listen, I know that it would be in my best interest to kill these people, but I can't because God wouldn't like it. Like that is real integrity. That is a commitment to a higher purpose that like changes the interior heart of someone and ultimately changes the world around them. And also, I think we live in a society that at this point in history has accepted as fact, as a dogmatic fact, that it is good to protect the weak, which is a Christian thought. And now I don't think everybody lives that way, but I think most people who want to have cultural capital, operate in the world, be perceived as a good person, would cling to that fact. And a lot of people in our culture today still believe that without accepting that is an idea that came to them from God, or they don't believe that it's important to protect the weak because the weak are loved by God, because he gives them dignity, or because he told us to. It's just something that seems obvious to them. And I think that's why, to me, I was like, I don't know that I can answer that question or care to answer that question, because there is a world, I think, where it serves the devil's purpose for people to believe that they can be good without God, and so therefore cling to the surface of Christian ethics and remove God from the picture, which will ultimately it won't lead to the fruit, but they'll still believe, they'll still act that way. They'll still behave that way, just without the genuine rewards that come from that. So I think it is possible that society almost deliberately appropriates everything they like about Christianity. It makes them feel comfortable. It makes them feel warm inside, and totally separates that from a commitment, an integral commitment to who, yes, to God's character, and continues to operate in a democratic way, in a respect for other people way, without really understanding why that's important or where it comes from. So I think that society could continue to operate, calling itself a democracy, believing itself as a city on a hill, without actually being that on the inside. I also think that it's possible that they revolt fully, that, you know, they say Christianity no longer controls us, we're free from our oppressors, we can go back to our hedonistic ways, and it all burns down, or whatever, right? But that pendulum, to me, I'm not convinced, and maybe I should have said this earlier, but I'm not convinced that because Christianity is popular, it is also authentic. Just because everybody is like paying lip service to it, or the majority is paying lip service to it, I'm not convinced that that really means that the majority of people are in a real and honest and committed relationship with God. And so when they stop paying lip service, in reality, they're actually going to start living in a way that is more honest and maybe more vulnerable. Maybe we'll open some doors for God to do some real work, because they're not pretending anymore, and they can look themselves in the eye and say, actually, you know what? I believe a lot of messed up stuff. Maybe, I don't know. To me, though, there's a heart issue here that philosophy just can't touch. And it would not be surprising for me for the culture at large to adopt a lot of Christian ideas and erase God's name as the author of those ideas.
Yeah, Ben, a couple things come to mind when you say that. Is one, I think we've all heard of the Jefferson Bible. You know, like
Sorry, say that again.
The Jefferson Bible. You know, Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, he's like, I kept all the stuff I liked, but I got rid of all the miraculous Jesus, you know?
Which I think you could make an argument is teaching a Christian ethic. Not well, but it's you know, it's still, there's something that there's an artifact of it still there.
Yeah. And my point is that this is not a new phenomenon.
Right.
Like we're not talking about like, oh, you know, yes, 4% of Gen Z has a biblical worldview. But like, what's the definition of a biblical worldview?
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
What are the you know, doctrinal things that this Barna has class, like Barna did a report on this. What did they classify as being a worldview? How does that differ from a Lutheran worldview? How does that differ from a Baptist worldview? How does that differ from a Catholic or a Protestant or a, you know, do I have that same biblical worldview? Like, is there some, you know, I think we talked when we were talking about this podcast before that there are essentials and non-essentials. Like, what are the non-essentials that are classified in that Barna's biblical worldview that I'm like, hey, I'm not even there. Like, that non-essential is not something I'm interested in. Yeah. Or it's not even a factor that I deem important enough to have a stance or a decision on, such as like immersion baptism, you know, right. Or are you sprinkled? Are you immersed? Like, what was the posture of your heart? And did you profess Jesus, you know? Yeah. And so when I think about what you're talking, American politics has been abused by, you know, lip service individuals, you know, that you're talking about since the beginning, like since Jefferson. Using the ethics of Christianity, which my argument I mentioned before is that it had permeated society. You have the Magna Carta, right? Like you have English common law. You have these things that have like permeated society, and the question really comes is like how much of the lay, like how much of the non-leadership, actually even cared.
Sure.
You know, it's like I just want to be left alone. I mean, you do have the fact that a bunch of Texans went to Mexico because Mexico offered them free land. And then they're like, no, we don't like this. We're going to be Texas. So like, there is a certain spirit of America that is always about individual freedom and liberty. And is that righteous to break your covenant? You know what I mean? Like, is that what a Christian does if they go to another country and then says like, never mind, we're revolting, not because you did anything wrong, just because we don't like the terms anymore. That's not a very Christian thing to do. It's not long suffering. It's not keeping to your word. And so my point there, and it's probably not a good example, is that I don't know if there is a degradation, can we call it a degradation, or has it always just been this way? And it's just our time to like fight against the unrighteousness or call out the unrighteousness because we want to walk in righteousness, like pursuing that sanctification, justification, right? Like as part of our lives to, you know, the ultimate glorification that is promised. So I just think that's an interesting thing you bring up on, you know, will the United States continue to exist? I think so. But I also have a friend of mine, John Lovell with the Warrior Poet Society. He says, and this has stuck with me for so long, for years now. He says, when historians 300 years from now, if Christ doesn't come back in that time, look back. Will they say America fell in 1992? Like, are we already living past the time where America will be deemed by historians to have fallen? And that is a sobering thought in general. And so, but I would also argue that every generation has that same plight of questioning. Like, has America already fallen? Like the kids that came of age in the early 1800s whose parents were the revolutionaries, did the parents think, oh, this generation is not going to carry the mantle forward? You know, and a part of me then looked at that and says, it's the foundational building. It's the what happened in the 1780s when the Constitution was made, that it was made in a way to withstand a certain amount of corruption, because of the values with which it was established. So, and I support this by, you have the American Revolution, right? And the next like actual bloody revolution of note is the French Revolution, which is like decades of trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. But every other system of government, including the Israel, which is maybe like one of the most recent parliamentary systems to be enacted successfully, they're all parliamentary systems. And you guys know Tyler, my brother, he would say, the parliamentary system is the best form of government in the world. he now does not hold that thought anymore after living in England for, you know, a few years. But there, and the reason I believe that majority of the systems are parliamentary is because it reduces the choice capacity of each citizen. So what do? You get one vote. You vote for your representative. That representative goes to parliament, and they vote, and they make a coalition, and they decide who's going to lead everything, and you don't really have a say except on your rep. And it looks to me that everyone looked at America and was like, wow, we don't want that. What can we give our people just enough so that they feel free?
Sure.
But they're not really. The American experiment that has endured gives the people more choice in government than any other government on the face of the planet. We not only select a senator, we select two senators, and we select a representative based on where we live. But as a people, not only do people select one representative, states have different representatives based on their population. And then the people elect a president. And then that president confirms his staff that are confirmed by the people, or nominates his staff that are confirmed by the people that the people voted for in Congress. So there's all of these checks. And then the president appoints a Supreme Court that justices that have to be confirmed by the numerous people that the people of the country have elected. And so there's this intricate web system. You know, if anyone's listening, like, the president doesn't make laws, just in case you thought that. The president isn't elected and laws are made. Like, there's a complex system that is founded with one goal in mind, and it was to protect the individual liberty of the people of America. And that whole premise, in my mind, comes from Christian thought. It's to treat people well. You know, we see feudal England, we see feudal, like, horrible things in feudal Japan, like people just being cut up because samurais, they looked at samurais the wrong way. Like, every other form of government, even when Christians were involved, people got screwed. Like, it just did. And so there came a point, you know, I don't know that the Enlightenment was the best thing for Christianity, but there came a point where, you know, the Enlightenment came about because Protestants and Catholics were killing each other, and the children of those people were just tired of it. So there comes a point where there's a value on individual liberty. I referenced the Magna Carta earlier, which really wasn't for the people. It's for the lords and barons, and, you know, it's still more feudal in nature. But because I'm getting long-winded here, beating a dead horse, it's been dead for a while. But it's because of the way the country was structured under the Constitution. That is why I think it will persevere. It has, America has a strong foundation, not just in its people, not in the people's hearts, but in the way the government functions, because of the ethics and the morals, you know, perpetrated, like, all through society and in the world from Christianity. You know, Rome didn't bring anything good to the world. Christianity brought goodness to the world. Like, the Greeks were a horribly savage society. It was Christianity that brought all the good things to the Western world. And it's not even a Western religion. It was in Africa before it was ever in Europe. You know, it's just an interesting thing. So I agree with Ben Battles that America will sustain beyond a Christian nation. Will Christians in the country be happy about it? No, absolutely not. I don't think so. But I also think there's an important note not to be deceived. You know, when Trump was elected in 2016, there were all the memes on social media of, like, Jesus carrying luggage in the desert. He's like going back to the White House. And, like, how deceptive is that? Like, we all know Trump is not a righteous man of God.
Yeah,
he wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And nor is Biden, you know, and I don't think Obama was. And you could argue that Bush might not have been. So, like, my point in going back is there is a deception that Christians have that you have to vote red or vote blue or whatever your convictions say religiously. And it's just, you have to remove Christianity, as Ben, you were talking about, like, a personal lifestyle. Like, it's the impact of my life. And so thus, will the nation continue? Yeah, I think so. Until Lincoln's prophecy comes through and we destroy ourselves from within, which is likely.
Sure. I guess to an extent, to kind of go off both of what y'all were saying, you know, I think it's definitely a fair point that if you consider you know, if you consider the people in this country who, as Battles was saying, are essentially paying lip service, that it's not really a deep abiding aspect of their life, that they are believers. They sort of follow God insofar as they say there is a God. You know, with and Harrison talking about how the principles and the precepts that have been around for several hundred years don't just simply vanish when Christianity vanishes. If Christianity wasn't necessarily present when they were introduced into society. To me, though, I still, and again, not that this is an attempt at conversion or anything, but I definitely don't, I still heartily disagree, in the sense that, you know, to me, this idea that if people honor Christianity to the extent they do now because it's popular or because it is simply in our soil as a country, that if Christianity goes away, if the edifice on top of which it's built, or if the sort of perfunctory pressure people feel to be viewed as Christian goes away, to me, what's unique about democracy in America is that it takes itself, I don't want to say seriously because that's too cavalier. It takes itself and recognizes that it is something special. And I don't believe in replacement theology. Israel will always be Israel. God will always love Israel. I don't believe America has replaced Israel. I don't believe that at all,
right.
Nor will any country. But I do think that America is secondarily unique in its function and in its purpose. And that only comes about because it's a nation that has, at least in part, had enough people who honor God and bless it, and bless his name. And if you have too many who turn away from that, then that's when the system itself begins to fail, because in part it's held up by God who we're honoring. And so if we cease to honor him who holds it, then we're not really holding anything together. Yes, we have control more so locally than federally, just because of representation status. But we're not really in the business of maintaining things or in determining where things are going. This complex web of God's sovereignty and our free will. And the Bible doesn't really clearly say the interaction between those. In fact, it kind of treats them very paradoxically. And so I would say that if you remove Christianity from our society as the driving ethic, what happens is, whether or not people desire still to take care of the weak, to look after children, to focus on helping the poor, eventually it becomes distorted, right? Because then what are you judging it by? You're judging it by yourself, right? And then I think the end goal of that, and I don't say this in dramatic terms. That's not my point. I think we end up with a society similar to Judges, where people just do as they thought was right. And so even if people think it's right to protect the weak, it's not going to function as it should. And if something's not functioning as it should, it's by its nature isn't working, right? It is falling apart. I just think, to go back briefly, you know, when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, he says something so fascinating. He's talking to him about being born again, and Nicodemus cannot grasp it. He's like, I don't understand how one could be born again. It doesn't make sense to me. And Jesus basically says, if you can't understand an aspect of my kingdom that has an earthly parallel, how could you understand aspects of my kingdom that have no earthly parallel? Is basically what he says to him.
Sure.
And so I think in part that what is unique about America is that there's not really another parallel on the earth for what it has operated as. And if people begin to leave, quote unquote, the kingdom, then they lose sight of what it's like. And if this is meant to be a parallel of the kingdom, then it goes with it, is my contention.
I see that. And I think I agree, but
I hope that made sense. That was somewhat jumbled, but I hope it made sense.
No, it made sense to me. I won't speak for Ben Battles, who has a higher intellectual capacity than both of us.
Amen. He does.
But I think like you can wrestle with both in tension, like the tension of the and that, you know, it's one of the great, a great thinker should be able to hold two opposing thoughts in contention at the same time. Right. And, yeah. And one, yes, the American system, I think, will continue to have resilience and be anti-fragile, regardless of the fluctuation of practicing Christians in the country. But I also see where, instead of taking care of widows and orphans, you're trying to save the foxes. Instead of taking care of, you know, widows and orphans, you're trying to save the whales. Like, things become distorted, the sanctity, and we already see that now. Like,
right.
we see people, like, I see it all the time on Facebook, and it drives me nuts. But it's these when humanity is gone and nature is all as it should be, everything will be peaceful. It's like that person has never seen a pack of wild dogs rip an embryo, like a fetus zebra, out of the belly of its mother while the zebra tries to run away and then, like, eat them both. Like, nature is brutal. Like, it's the most brutal thing we humans can engage with. Like, there's nothing more brutal than nature. And it's when humans choose to be animalistic, like what we saw with Hamas attacking Israel, like this past weekend, that's the closest humanity gets, I think, to, like, true nature. I mean, I guess you could be mauled by a bear. Like, yeah, you came face to face with the brutality of nature. Like, you froze to death. Like, that's not really a major concern in most areas of the United States right now. And so my point is, I don't want to get too down a rabbit trail, is as Christianity begins to become less popular, or even maybe the term less prevalent, as future generations have a decreasing value on religion in general, we'll see, like, as the word says, like, what is bad will be good and what is good will be bad. Like, people will celebrate that which is evil and call evil that which is good, right? And so I think that both those things can happen at the same time, that the foundation laid by our founders, who were devout men, whether or not they all had all their ducks in a row with a biblical worldview remains to be seen. I mean, it's already been proven false, but that can be persistent and undamaged by a reduction in Christianity, but the values of the country will flip on their head, and the things that God values, the country will no longer value. But then what does that mean for the system of government? As I mentioned earlier, like, Christianity is almost an X factor to government, not necessarily a prerequisite for government, you know, because you have governments all over the world that aren't Christian, including ours, but you see the worst human rights atrocities in countries that are not Christian. I mean, even you look at Japan, the human rights atrocities during the feudal Japan were nuts, were crazy. But then you can look at the Portuguese church and Japan's desire to be Western and to seize and grab onto the prosperity of the West. And maybe that's why we don't have any human rights atrocities. Look at North Korea and South Korea. South Korea want to be Western, supported by the United States. It's like they're feeding off of a structure that was established through centuries of Christian thought, and they're benefiting in a post-Christian world from that structure that's been established. While at the same time, they may not be valuing the same things that God would value because they're not a Christian people for the most part. Even though the Christian church now in Korea is exploding, it's huge. But transverse that with North Korea, where there is no Christianity, Christianity is illegal, it's evil. Marines, like, eat their babies, you know, as to become Marines, like all the weird stuff that they think about the American people. The opposites, Western influence versus no Western influence, and the human rights atrocities is stark and worth noting. So I may be getting off topic, but that's just the thought I'm having.
I I'm going to address something, some of what you were saying, Rollins, there, and, you know, stop me if I'm like, I'm trying to paraphrase, so stop me if I'm like putting words in your mouth, but something that you were getting at, I think stuck out to me. Mm-hmm. And I think a clarification on that might illustrate my side. But you were kind of hinting at that if something is operating as it should, it will succeed. Is that a fair kind of like approximation of what you were saying? Like, if it does what it should do, it will succeed.
I would say if it does what it should, it will. If it does what it should, it will last. Okay. Succeed, I think, is hard to say.
Sure. And that question, well, so success, or, you know, doing what you should do, I think is subjective. And if,
based,
you know,
on value?
Yeah, I mean, it can be based on a lot of things, right? So if we say, you know, is America doing what it should do? America as a whole, America as a macro organism, is it doing what it should do? I personally would say no, from the perspective that what it should do is repent of its sins, confess, you know, to the Lord, cry out for help from God, you know, submit yourselves fully to his will. And I absolutely do not think that that is where we are as a country, that that is the pervasive mindset of I submit fully to the Lord. I do not think that's where we are. But if what I think the perception of what a country should do is provide a sense of stability, provide an opportunity for pleasure, provide, you know, the pursuit of happiness. That's what's, you know, kind of written into our, you know, our founding documents there, that this idea that I should have the opportunity to make myself happy. And I think America is fully believing that it is on that path of providing the opportunity to make itself happy. And I don't think that that necessarily, I think that without Christianity, it could continue to do that. It could continue to pursue the path that it perceives as making itself happy. And I think it could do that successfully. And I think that history tells us that that is possible. When you look at like the birth of Christianity under the occupation of Rome, Rome was in existence as a successful, depending on your metric of success or, you know, what it should be doing. It lasted for a lot longer than America has lasted, and then converted to Christianity and collapsed. I mean, granted, it collapsed under the pressure of outside forces, but this idea that it was Christian thought that made it what it was or saved it, I think it is the Christian thought that allowed it to metamorphosize. You know, Rome ultimately collapses, but a lot of it survives in the Catholic Church. You know, it metamorphosized. The vestiges of Rome clung on to the coattails of God's story and rose up as Christianity survived from, you know, from those fires. And it became something else, and it evolved into something else. And I think that that continued to happen, that, you know, as Europe, you know, was embroiled in, you know, all kinds of conflict and ultimately would revolt and turn to democracy. It was partially because Christianity, a desire to not have their faith limited by the government, was, you know, escaped from that. And so I think that, like, will the government last? Will it do what it should? What it should do is honor God, and very, very rarely, I mean, possibly never has that happened in our history, that a government has actually been what it should do. I listened to a podcast recently that kind of blew my mind, where they were talking about the story of Jonah and interpreting it as literature, interpreting it as, you know, a story that is a parable about God's character and about his nature. And that really at the heart of that story is, what if Israel did what it was supposed to do, which was convert the nations, right? So Jonah goes to Nineveh and preaches this message of forgiveness and acceptance, that God loves them and wants to see them transformed. And then they repent. And it was kind of this picture of, like, has Israel really done that? No, you've tried to protect yourselves, And sometimes that succeeds, sometimes it doesn't, but have you reached out into the world and converted them? Now, this Jonah is a satire, is poking at the inability or the unwillingness even of God's chosen people to actually do what he said to do. And I think about this verse all the time. This will be no surprise to anyone, but I'm about to bring us into Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 2:26, it says, to the person who pleases him being God, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering up and storing wealth to hand it over one day to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. But Solomon is lamenting about how I could spend my whole life chasing wealth, and when I die, it'll just end up in someone else's hands. Is that really the way that I should spend my life? And then he says to the sinner, like he says specifically to the sinner, their task, their purpose in existence, if you don't repent, if you don't acknowledge God, the whole purpose for your existence is basically to be a bank of blessings, to just hold on to it until it can fall into the hands of the person who pleases God. And it's not hard for me to believe that if that can be true for individuals, it can also be true for the nations, that Rome was allowed to succeed until they needed to pass on their blessings to the movement of Christianity. And America maybe is the same. Maybe it is just a holding place, that it is amassing influence, might, protection, wealth, for some purpose that we have not yet seen down the road. And our perceived success, I think a lot of people would say you're doing it right if you're amassing wealth. But the writer of Ecclesiastes would say, but yeah, what's your point? What's your purpose? What is that really all there is to just have more, is to have more of it? God is using you as a stopping point, as a holdover, for someone who actually sees the real picture and can enjoy it and appreciate it and savor it in the way that that we were designed to. I was going to say something else with that. I lost my train of thought. But yeah, I think it's very possible that America will continue to succeed without honoring God. But for what point, right? Like, it's just a selfish, you know, hedonistic blip in time before God can do something that actually matters with it.
It's interesting you make that connection to Ecclesiastes, in that, you know, people often misinterpret the famous quote by Nietzsche where he talks about the death of God, where his contention is that it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
Right. His contention is that it's disastrous, and that ultimately it leads to a sort of like destructive nihilism, where, you know, there is no meaning, there is no sort of, there is no additional theistic driven purpose. You know, you're just finding whatever meaning you can scrap together, whatever worldview makes the most sense for you. And you know, in that regard, you know, I think not only biblically, but philosophically, you know, a lot of postmodernists will use Nietzsche and Sartre and other such people. And to me, it's one of those instances where philosophy and one of those intended meeting points between philosophy and biblical doctrine meet up, so to say.
I guess those that don't know, Ben Battles was all about Ecclesiastes in college.
That's true.
Just for context, you know, all the time. That's why I laughed. And he's like, won't be a surprise. So, inside joke, sharing with you audience.
Ben also, and it was not surprising at all that Harrison mentioned being mauled by a bear, because I'm pretty sure he's still convinced he could win that fight.
I can.
There it is. I knew that. As soon as you brought in that bear, I was like, I knew in his head he was thinking, I could beat that bear. In his own reference. That's what he was thinking about.
Revenant, that's my life.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Out of my life. I have a mountain lion that's patrolling my property here. I live in Texas. And I'm just like waiting for the opportunity to like face it with a tomahawk in the middle of the night under the glow of the moon, you know, like a scene from Predator or something. Just like totally down a rabbit trail, but they got to know who we are too.
They got to know.
They'll definitely learn from that.
Yeah. The mountain lion, they're not going to be able to see it, but the mountain lion got a hold of my daughter's doll.
Oh no.
It's all ripped up, but testament to the manufacturer, Aliella. They don't sponsor the podcast, but maybe they should.
Very good. That's perfect. That's awesome.
Yeah. What does this say about Mountain Lion Society? You know, where are they headed?
Yeah. And, you know, they need Jesus more than anyone else, right?
I'm actually going to change the driving question is, can American democracy survive without mountain lions? I think that's the more pressing question. I don't think it can.
It's open season in Texas for mountain lions. So,
I don't think it can.
Maybe the state differs with you then.
I will say I think what's interesting to me so far about this conversation is that to me it, I don't want to say reveals, because I think for most people it would be pretty apparent, but this subject is complex and layered, but this driving question of, as I can't remember if it was Inferior Ben or Harrison had mentioned, I'm just kidding, was, you know, people want exact dates for things, particularly events that are going to be bad. Yeah. They want to know, like, if we think of it on a trivial scale, when's my show getting canceled? I want to know so I can figure out whether to invest in this or not. When is the last tour date of this band so I know when my deadline is to go see them? When is this thing due so I know I can turn it into the last possible moment? You know, when is, and then obviously on the huge scale, right? When is something bad going to happen, whether it's like an invasion, a war, a natural disaster? And so we're definitely obsessed with that, with the why and the how and the when. And that by itself isn't necessarily problematic. But I think what can become problematic is if you take the benefits of something, whether that's the benefit of someone else's fruit, of an organization's fruit, their production, that you begin to put yourself or your group or your community in a position where you lack self-sufficiency, in that you're relying even almost like accidental self self-sufficiency, in that you're sort of, you're unaware that you are attached to something that's providing for you. And so to me, I guess, in a sense, to kind of bring the conversation to sort of a culmination point, is that on the one hand, I think, yes, this idea that, you know, non-Western countries function and can thrive without in a kind of democracy, in a sort of a structure akin to and derivative of our own, can succeed, can function. But to me, it all points back to the fruit of American Christianity and its democracy, its governmental structure. I think that, you know, and I'll mention this as sort of a biblical reference. You know, in Jesus, when he's talking about the parable of the sower and the seed, talks about how, there are different soils it can land upon. There are different growth metrics. There's different outcomes. But at the end of the day, there are different kinds of yield. And I don't think the yields were mentioned to illustrate this idea that abundance and growth are part of the kingdom. Because I think that is true, but that there are different measures of abundance that you can enter into as a Christian, and right, that is dependent upon your heart. That is dependent upon how much of it, when you are in a season of favor, do you drive deeper into the heart and design of your purpose, which is not self honor, which is not self aggrandizement, but is kind of pointing the finger back at God. And so to me, it's, I don't contend this question or this statement as sort of meant to be a gotcha by any means, but I think the reality that we're able to have a discourse like this, to live the lives we live, for our friends to live the lives they do, for the people in this country to function as they do, is the residual fruit from people before us, in that, you know, it's easy to obsess with what I was saying earlier. When are things going to come to a close? When are things finally going to come to an end? When are things going to stop working out? But I think the better question is, what can we do to forestall what eventually comes? And I think we see this throughout the Old Testament of people, prophets, people of Israel asking God to forestall the coming judgment. And at times he does, right? He stays his hand. I think in part it's, if you have, and this is speculation, I'm not claiming this is scriptural. I think it is that occurs when you have enough people who are willing to honor God in some capacity and plead to him, then I think there is that mercy. There is that chance to still live off the residual fruit from previous generations. I think about Hezekiah when he approaches the, I'm sorry, not Hezekiah. I think it was King Hezekiah when, I believe it's Isaiah the prophet or some other who comes to him and basically says, you're going to die. And he says, no, please. And the Lord says, go back. He's got a certain number of years left of his reign. And I think it's one of those things where, because we're still predominantly a Christian nation driven by a Christian ethic, there's enough people, there's enough whatever it is the Lord is looking for that says, please, a little bit longer. And I think when that goes away, then I think what is there forestalling the judgment of the Lord, in that there comes a time when mercy gives way. The Lord is full of infinite capacities, and eventually those emerge into a situation that I think we could see where, when Christianity fades in America, that it does so as a country in all capacities.
Yeah, it's interesting, Ben. My thoughts as you're talking there come to compassion. So basically selflessness versus selfishness. And I see this a lot right now. I mentioned Israel before. And I see an outcry against what Hamas has done in Israel because of the people, because people have compassion on the Israelis and the savage acts that happen. And they're like, oh, my heart breaks for those people. And that is the appropriate response. And then in another camp of Christians, I see, yes, this was supposed to happen because, you know, Israel did not uphold its covenant with God, or, you know, X, Y, Z, right? And they're purely focused on Israel for an eschatological reason. You know, it's like, Israel's important in the end times. Israel's important because Jesus walked there, but not compassion for the people. And so you say forestall, like the judgment of God. And my mind, of course, goes to judgment day, like Christ coming back, you know, the end times. And there is a compassion. And I think this goes to the virtue of what we're talking about, that the person has to have. It's because people have to uplift a cry that says, you know, tarry, Lord, right? Like, wait,
right?
Because I have compassion for the lost, you know? It's like that response with Israel, like, oh, I'm sad for the Israelis, or I'm sad because of what Israel means biblically. Like, those are two totally different stances. And one is selfish and one is selfless.
Right.
And compassion to be a motivating factor in the lives of the individual Christian is crucial, because then you say, Lord, prolong my suffering. You know, we're young men, we're in our 30s. And it's almost like, Lord, prolong my suffering into my 90s. Who wouldn't love for, like, God to come back in their 50s? It's like, before my body starts to like degrade, Jesus comes back. I just go up. Woo! My kids are grown. You know, like everyone's had everything. Like, great. I have lived a good life. I don't have to like decline. That's a selfish prayer almost in my mind. Versus Lord Terry, so that more can be saved.
Right.
I had an example, but I'm not as quick with as Ben Battles is recovering on my lost thoughts. So I may have just let that one slip away. But I think that as long as people remain compassionate about the right things, as we talked about earlier, about the heart of God, what God wants, and putting aside even conversations, even speech about like, oh, I hope God comes back soon. Things are just getting bad. It's like, yeah, but Paul says, Lord, I'd rather be with you in heaven, but it is better that I'm here on earth to minister. Right? There's a yearning for the things of heaven, but he endures the long suffering. He endures the torture, the beheading, all those things that he knows is coming because he's like, I have to serve people.
Right.
And I know we've kind of shifted from American culture to the individual life, but even now, like we see, if you want to shape culture, you have to shape individual lives.
Yeah.
Fathers and mothers have to shape their children. You don't just, it's like poverty. You don't just like flip a switch and all of a sudden three generations are no longer impoverished.
Right.
It's like you have to start with that fourth generation. And that fourth generation has to have an experience of life to shake off the bonds of poverty. And then that child grows up, is not impoverished, and then can take care of potentially two generations back, because ideally the third generation that would have died by then. And that's how you break the cycle of poverty. You do it through the next generation. And there's a form of long suffering there. There's a form of compassion that has to happen, but you can't just flip a switch and America's Christian. Like, oh, America needs to be saved. Like, no, you have to invest in the next generation. And I think all of us as kind of charismatic individuals, faith-wise, spiritually charismatic, as well as maybe personally charismatic. You know, if we were playing Dungeons and Dragons or something, I'm sure we'd all have high charismatic rankings. But anyway, my point being that the focus to save America has to be on Generation Alpha. Because Gen Z, I'm not saying they're doomed, millennials are not doomed, but the culture of that generation has already been set. Not saying that God can't come and just like revival and like everyone in their 40s gets saved. But statistically speaking, like Strauss-Howe generational theory, Gen Z is Gen Z and they're not going to change. Gen Alpha is still malleable and permeable to be a generation that is for the Lord. And that's, in my mind, how you avert any sort of, you use the term judgment. I would look at, because I, you know, mercy triumphs over judgment, but there is a breaking point where judgment happens. But I would say like the Lord removes his favor from America.
Right.
You know, and then without that favor, calamity can happen, like 9/11, mass shootings, mass suicides, you know, the dystopian society that if you showed someone in the 50s, they would be horrified as, you know,
right,
what America is today. So we're living in Hunger Games. Just not quite that bad yet.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to volunteer for you, Harrison, for that Hunger Games. Yeah. Sorry, man.
That's okay. As long as there's bears involved, I'll volunteer.
Too funny.
I think for me, it still goes back to my almost initial response that if you want to look at it from a serious spiritual perspective, that God is real and he has a plan, it becomes so, so difficult as a human who is not omniscient to project onto that and say what that plan is and interpret the status of the world as an indicator of God's plan. I think a lot of the prophets who prophesied doom for Israel prophesied in times of prosperity. And it was really, really easy for those kings to say, look at the favor that we have. Obviously, we're doing it right. God doesn't mind that we're worshiping idols or whatever. And that just wasn't true.
Yeah.
And so I can't say, I mean, I know too many verses that would counter this to say that, like, oh, that's not how God operates. He doesn't give favor, you know, to nations or to individuals based on, you know, their what they've done or whatever. But what that means, what that actually turns out to mean, I think could mean so many different things. I mean, I think God had favor on Peter when he calls him the rock and says, I'll build my church around you. And then Peter dies a martyr's death, which is not the way that most of us would perceive favor. But Jesus said, like, this is, you'll be like me. You'll be elevated to a status that is similar to myself. And I think most people would despise that and not call it favor, but it absolutely was. And so has America,
I said God's ways are higher.
Yeah. And so has America enjoyed some sense of favor because of a Christian ethic? Maybe. And maybe also we think that's what we're doing. Like with the Ecclesiastes verse, we're really just holding on to a wealth of blessings for the one who can appreciate it, who can really, what's the word I'm looking for? Transmute that
right
out into something else, into something eternal as opposed to temporal.
I still kind of
find myself in that space of like, I really don't know. And I think similar to what Harrison was saying, the real question is like, what am I going to do with the moment that's right in front of me? I think humans' abilities to shape history only exists in cooperation with God. Like, should he be so kind as to give us a prophetic vision or a direction?
Right.
But beyond that, it really is like, did you follow the commandments today? You know, is there something you could do to be better at following the commandments tomorrow? That I think those are the real, for me personally, those are the real questions that like, my ability to influence America to become more Christian is, I don't know. It just really is in the hands of God in so many ways.
Yeah. Getting strong Gandalf vibes from you. We can only do what we can.
That's right.
To us, yeah. The great philosopher Tolkien. I want to just read a verse here that I think it's been on my heart, especially the last couple weeks or the last week with Israel. You know, I work in that space, and so it's just been a comfort. And Jesus has just predicted the destruction of the temple. He's like, I will destroy the temple. Do you see all these things? Truly, I tell you, not one stone will be left here on another that will not be thrown down. Like he's just done this. And so while he is sitting on the Mount of Olives, so Matthew 24:3, while he's sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples approach him privately and said, tell us, when will these things happen? And what is the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Like when you just talked about the temple being destroyed, when is that going to happen? Tell us, like we're your bros, right? Tell us. And Jesus replied to them, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and they will deceive many. You are going to hear of wars and rumors of wars, and see that you are not alarmed, because these things must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these events are the beginning of labor pains. And then you talk about the favor like of Peter. Then they will hand you over to be persecuted, and they will kill you. You will be hated by all the nations because of my name. Many will fall away, betray one another, hate one another. Many false prophets will arise up and deceive many, because lawlessness will multiply. The love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. This good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed in all the world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. I mean, it just keeps going. It's so good. But you know, it goes on to talk about Daniel and you know the Great Tribulation, yeah, and stuff. And so there's comfort. Ben Rollins, what you said earlier, Ben the Greater. For those listening, Ben Rollins is like twice the height of Ben Battles.
Actually three times. Ben Battles is like 3 foot tall. Yeah.
I shrank since last time.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Yep. But
he actually has no torso.
Four legs. He's only ever worn jeans. He just like floats over shoes.
Yeah.
Ben Rollins, you were saying earlier that there are things that are set in motion, like the beginnings of labor pains. Like we all know labor pains come. Like there's no way around labor pain. I mean, you can get an epidural, but like still there's no way around it. And then the end, like all these things are preordained. Does that mean God ordained the attack of Hamas on Israel? No, I don't necessarily think so. Because there is that element of like free action and like, right. God doesn't make us sin. He doesn't make us sin, but we choose to sin. But the fact that these things, he knows they're going to happen. These things are going to happen. And America will fall one day. It's inevitable. I believe America will continue to become less Christian. And we will hear about these things from the Amish to the Bible Belt to the Alaskan frontier and everywhere. And I pray that the churches of the South, there's so many, that the churches of the South will take a lesson from the churches in the North and stop being culturally Christian. There's a difference between a church in New York City than a church in Atlanta, Georgia. There just is. There's a difference between a church in Chicago and a church in Dallas, because the people in Chicago and the people in New York who are Christians are in it for real. There is no cultural Christianity in the North. It is true faith. And I hope that the South will embrace that. And so there's all these prophetic podcast streams out there, and there's all these people all over saying the end is nigh. The big one is like, God's about to expose all the corruption and evil of the Democratic Party. Like that one's, I've heard that for
years. I've heard that as well. Yeah.
You know, and it's like, okay, if he does, great. If he doesn't, great. Like you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but just know that these things will happen. So just taking comfort for me in that, God has been, the battle said earlier, almost have been a lesser. I can't diminish you that way.
Totally.
But Ben Battles has said that the ways of God, the mysteries of God, we have to become okay with them. We have to become okay with not knowing the what's and the why's.
Yes.
Because the Bible, like I've heard it said so many times, they're like, oh, the Bible's got everything you need. It's the roadmap to life. The Bible can answer all questions you have. Like, what happens if you have a transgender child? Like, you're not going to find a verse in the Bible about how to handle that situation with decorum and love.
That's right.
And power. You're just not. It's not in there. And so there are things that the Holy Spirit wanted the biblical authors to tell us. There are things that they're not interested in us knowing, going back to the mysteries. And so it's just important for anybody listening. You hear rumors of war, just note them, but don't dwell on them. Don't become obsessed with them. Keep your eye on Jesus. Ben Battles said something to me in college that's coming to mind right now. It really has been profound for my life. And so cool, like blessing on you, Ben, right? But, but you said, it isn't that I need to spend all my time learning who the Antichrist is. I need to spend all my time learning who Jesus is. And so that when the Antichrist shows up, I'll be like, no, I know Jesus and you are not him. It's not because you've identified the signs of the Antichrist, but you know God so intimately and so well that you recognize a false countenance or a false image of Jesus. And so that we are not deceived as Jesus is telling us. And how cool is it that we have like the literal words of Jesus?
That's right.
That they're highlighted red in some Bibles. Like, it's just cool that Jesus has, it's like the word of Jesus is what we're going on here, not anything else.
Yeah. And so I think that's a good word. No, absolutely. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, as Jesus is talking to his disciples, right, he, what does he say to them? Lo, I'll be with you until the very end of the age. You know, it's at the end of the day, thankfully, we can put our trust wholly and infinitely within our, whatever is our capacity in the Lord. And know that, you know, not only is there comfort in living within the commandments of God, there's blessing and structure and protection, but also it's this notion that if you want more answers, you have to be willing to live with more mystery. they are proportional. If you do, you know, if you do want to seek out and really seek the Lord and earnestly pray for answers and revelation and wisdom on some of these questions we've asked, talked about, or some of the sub questions that have come up through our conversation, the reality is those may come to you, but what also comes is more mystery. So it's about recognizing that, how do I put it? But recognizing that the Lord is good, and that as our shepherd, there's nothing that we lack. When we operate in that capacity and we begin to shift our focus outward, our goal is to help others come to know him so that they do not lack. I think, you know, in closing for me, it's, you know, if there are things that, you know, we've talked about that we've noticed, or that you've noticed in our country, in your society, in your home, that you feel are lacking or are diminished, all it means is that there's more room for God, and that there's room for growth, there's room for expansion, there's something so sweet about being able to trust in the Lord of Hosts, right? That would be my parting word.
It is so sweet to trust in Jesus.
It is.
As the old hymn says.
Yeah.
Yeah. Faith is a gift. So if you ever feel like you don't understand, you can't muster it up yourself, you have to just ask for it. Just ask God, give me faith. It's a fruit of the Spirit.
Help my unbelief.
You're not going to be able to understand on your own study. You have to ask for faith and have your eyes open to be able to see and to experience the Word of God. And it's not even just read the words; it's experiencing the Word of God. So you get giddy about reading the red words in the Bible, like, wow, that's from my Savior. Just ask for faith.
Ben, is there anything you want to do, want to add in here before I bring us to an end?
I don't know if this is super about the subject, but just a verse that I've been meditating on a lot the past 4 or 5 days is in James, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. And I'm skipping over a few lines, but that anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. I just think the world can do with a lot more listening.
Yeah, good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of listening, thank you for that segue, Ben. I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast, to Unscripted Study, Episode 0, a biweekly podcast about faith and society. Ben Battles, Harrison Cohn, thank you for being with me today. And for those listening, hope you all have a great week. God bless.